Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963. Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963. Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963.
Can you hear me? Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963. Solutions of Maxwell's Equations. Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963. Solutions of Maxwell's Equations. Lecture S-20, January 3rd, 1963, Solutions of Maxwell's Equations.
Examination, I wanted to congratulate you on doing so well. It encourages me, but I lost a bet on a consequence of it. Another little item I'd like to talk about that just came up was this graduate student came into my office, is getting his PhD and doesn't know what he's interested in. So I talked to him for a while and I asked him, well, how do you learn things? You talk to everybody, you talk to other fellows to find out what they're doing and see what's interesting. He says, no, I can't talk to anybody else. I said, why? He says, that would be talking shop. So I was absolutely horrified by such a thing. And so I discovered just a minute ago that the same disease appears in the undergraduate world. I would like to argue that it's a good idea to talk shop, that there's no known way of education. Teaching is a very inefficient and stupid business, and learning is a equally inefficient and stupid business. And every method that you could concoct in order to help you to learn is worth something. Some people have invented lectures. Other people have invented books. Some people have suggested the method of doing problems all the time. But there's another method, and that is to talk to somebody else about the thing. By talking to somebody else about something, and not necessarily a problem which is assigned, in fact, quite differently. If you're arguing about religion, you may ask about the relevance of the expanding universe to religion. So some fellow who's studying astronomy, who happens to have read a book a little bit about it, starts to discuss it. And pretty soon you wonder, how do you know the things are expanding? And then you learn about the Doppler effect and so on. Maybe you heard about it. So you talk back and forth and you begin to discuss a subject. You find out how the pieces of the world fit together. And you're learning about nature instead of solving a problem. By talking back and forth, also, you hone your ideas. That is, in order to explain something to somebody, you have to produce the idea again. And there's no way to find out how incompletely you know something. No problems will do any good until you try to explain it to somebody. In addition to that, when somebody explains something to you that you asked them about at that moment when your mind was ready to hear that subject because it was interested in that subject in the minute, then when somebody tells you something, it goes in much easier. When you come to a lecture in which the professor has decided what it is today that you're supposed to learn, your mind isn't set for it. You don't feel like learning that now. It's not interesting now. So for many reasons, it's a good idea to talk to another fellow. It'd be best if you can find someone at about the same level as you are or higher. Of course, the guy who's higher doesn't feel too much like talking to you. Well, it's not exactly true. He'll discover a certain pleasure that he gets out of feeling so smart because he can explain a thing to you. A, and B, he get a kick out of trying to concoct an explanation of something which he thinks he understands in a form in which he thinks you can understand it, which takes a certain skill. When I was undergraduate, we didn't have any rules about shop talk, and one of the reasons why I'm successful is because I found a friend who was at the same level as I was, and we talked about subjects all the time. And he knew more about, when we met, he knew the theory of quantum mechanics, and I knew some relativity, having read it in some books and so on. And it was only several months before we were equal. I learned quantum mechanics from him, and he learned relativity from me, and so on. And I always think that that's the most effective way to learn something. You say, well, we're too busy doing problems. Then I say, forget a problem. Spend the same amount of time talking about a subject to somebody else. Well, if I try to talk shop, some guy will say, you're only talking shop. Who is this guy? Is he smarter than you are in the subject? Does he have more interest in the science than you do? And he says that's peculiar. Anyway, suppose he does. Find somebody else. And if the worst comes to the worst, if this secret activity has to be done in the dark, then take you and your pal and go off for a walk and talk about something that interests you. It doesn't have to be the science. It's just something interesting. But don't restrict yourself. Remain absolutely free to discuss anything irrespective of what somebody else says as to whether it's interesting or not, provided the guy you're talking to finds it interesting. Never mind the third guy coming up. Oh, you are just talking shop. Let me tell you about my girlfriend, which he couldn't get a date with. Now, this method of talking shop was the oldest way of education. When there were smaller numbers of students, they claimed that the great Greek schools consisted of the professor walking around and discussing things with the students. I don't believe it. If you read the dialogues of Plato, you'll find out that Socrates never discussed anything with the students. He just told them a lot of stuff, and there was always a simplicio standing there to make some dumb remark at the appropriate point. However, if you were to go to a school in which dedicated dancing, say ballet dances, in some very special Russian school for ballet dances, and you'd see two dancers in their costumes walking out of a class, and you'd walk behind, you'd think you might expect to hear something about the ballet, something exciting about the ballet. You go to a school of theology, and you see these men in the cloth walking together quietly in the campus, and you walk up behind them to find out what they're talking about. You will be disappointed if you find that it's trivial, that it hasn't got something to do with God and religion. It usually does not, of course, because they can't talk about it all the time. But if you got the impression that these gentlemen walking together with their books in their hands never spoke of the subject to each other, you'd say there was something missing. They were making a great mistake and losing a great opportunity. And so I say the same way to you, that you had a school, and a school means like a school of fish, a lot of people together. And one of the reasons it's a good idea to be at a school is not that there are good lectures at the school, no, but that there's somebody else there from whom you can get some idea. You get a wide range of knowledge on all kinds of things by talking to all kinds of people. The total amount of experience that one human being can get through his senses directly is very small. Even when assisted by books, problems, and lectures, it's still small. But when another human being gets the same information and redigests it a different way and disgorges it to you still another way, you're widening your experience. So, I say it, you go in a corner and hide out with another guy and do the heresy of talking shop from time to time. I don't mean you have to talk about the particular equations and lectures of today, but you just talk about the world or whatever interests you freely. Okay, I hope someday to see two gentlemen walking quietly in their all right. Now, another item comes up to this year is that it turns out, as I look over what we're going to do, and I incidentally, to take some of the surprise out of these lectures, I've given a list in very crude form as to more or less what we're going to talk about. This is no guarantee. Some of these things may take more than one lecture. Some of them I may decide to leave out and so on. But this roughly this material. But one thing I notice is that for a change, everything we hear about will not be new. There'll be many things that have been talked about to a large extent before that we'll go over again. And so there'll be a lot of times when we have to refer to previous lectures, that it would be a good idea for you. One of the references, in other words, of this lecture is not another book, but a previous lecture. For instance, for this lecture, it would be good to read I-47. The I means the first year. Lecture 47, which was on this wave equation. The next lecture that we're going to give here would have as a reference the 28th lecture of the first year. Gee, my God, we had 52 lectures on electromagnetic radiation. And as we go along in these subjects in here, then you'll find that we'll be covering ground which was previously covered in these lectures here. This is about light. And these two lectures were about modes and waves of waves in confined spaces and so on. And the waves were sound in this case. But the waves of electricity do the same things as the waves of sound, and so we're just repeating the subject. So now I begin the main lecture today. Two lectures ago, we were talking about the Maxwell equations when we had them in complete form, and I've written them at the top of the blackboard. That's all you have to know. And we found that when we put all the equations together, a new remarkable phenomenon occurred, and that is that the fields that were generated could leave the sources. Fields could get away from the sources and travel in space. For example, we took a case in which we had a thin slab of width W, which was suddenly, at a given moment, given a current J upward, and found that if we looked at the situation after some time, that there was an electric, I make a plot vertically, represent the strength of the magnetic or electric field, which is, say, one unit or some unit in strength, and falls to zero out here in space. There's no fields out here, but there are fields here, and the fields had a characteristic something like this, that the magnetic field B was into the blackboard, and the electric field, I think, was down. And we could work out even the strength of the field, the strength of the electric and magnetic field were perpendicular, and the electric field was the speed of light times the magnetic field, and the magnetic field could be obtained from these currents here, and there was the width times over 2C epsilon naught times the current inside here. Out height is zero. Now, as time goes on, this front moves out, as long as the current is maintained. Well, anyway, this front moves out at a speed C, and that's a solution to the problem, what happens when you turn on a current. There's also a wave moving out in the other direction, but I didn't draw it. Now, I would ask the following. Suppose that we turn on a current of unit strength for a while, and then suddenly change it to three times the strength. This problem can be solved in the following way. First, we turn on a current of unit strength. Get the solution. Forever. Next, we turn on a current a little bit later of 2. So the additional current that we're adding, the additional current of 2 units, would make a field twice as high as this, which I can't draw on the board because I didn't give myself enough space. But this curve, in spite of its appearance, is twice as high as this one. But it would have spread not as far because this one was turned on later. Now, by the principle of superposition, if you have two solutions, you can add the solutions, provided you add the sources. And so we find a new problem. If we add both of these cases together, we have a current which is 1 for a while and then turns to 3. And a field which in space looks like this, 1 unit high for a while and then jumps to 3 units high and goes on. All right. Now I'm going to take a more complicated problem. We have a current which is 1 unit, and then after a while it's turned up to 3 units, and then after a while later it's turned off to 0. Well, how do I do that one? Same general idea. I do 3 problems. First, I turn on a current of unit strength. I solved that already. Next, a little later, I turn on a current of 2 units on top of it, so to speak. And that makes an additional field of 2 units. And then I turn on top of the whole thing a current of minus 3 units. So I have 3 problems to solve. 3 problems is a current of 1 unit starting at time 0, a current of 2 units starting at time, say, t1 or something, and then a current of minus 3 units starting at time t2. The solution for the last problem is a thing which is a negative 3 unit wave that's coming out. Now, if I add the 3 solutions together, then I'll get a solution that looks like this. Because the minus 3 wave added to the 3 produced exactly 0, the current here is now reduced to 0. Now, let's go back over this, what the history of it is. First, there's no current. Then there's unit current. Now, there's three times the current. Now, there's no current. And look what the field is doing. First, there's a unit strength. Then there's 3 times the strength. Then there's no strength. The field exactly imitates the current, but the field distribution is in space as a nice graph of the current. Of course, this entire thing, all these fronts move at the same speed, C, so that this little blob of field rides out with all the complications, with the complete memory and the great detail of exactly how the current varies. And therefore, if we stand miles away, we can tell after the event precisely what happened, how exactly the current varied, because the current's variation is completely represented in great detail in the shape of the variation of the electric and no other magnetic field. So this then represents a wave of electric and magnetic field, which now exists in the space away from the sources, gets further and further away, and in fact, the sources may in fact have completely stopped operations, and we still got the wave going on. That's the new phenomenon that is different because we have the Maxwell's equation than we had before. In fact, if you want a mathematical representation of the thing that we've just analyzed here, we can conclude that the field, the electric field, at a given place and at a given time, according to this kind of argument, is equal to W times 2C epsilon naught times the current that was there, not at the time t, but at the earlier time t, minus how far out you wanted to calculate the field divided by C. And this business, this moving wave, is represented by this formula. Actually, if you would like, the field is in the opposite direction to the current, but that's not the essential point. Incidentally, believe it or not, we've already derived this from another point of view. Yes, indeed. When we were dealing with the theory of index of refraction, we had to figure out what fields were produced by the oscillating dipoles in a sheet of glass or a gas. The dipoles were excited by the external forces of the field coming in, and they generated a new field. How could we have ever calculated the fields generated by moving charges when we didn't have Maxwell's equation? Because we at that time gave an arbitrary rule for what the fields are that are produced at large distances from the charges. And so we were able to demonstrate that at least at large distances from the source, this was right. We now realize, in fact, that this is right even right up to the source. It's right at any distance, but we only deduced it at relatively larger distances when we deduced it before. If you would like to find, I remember the equation now. I looked it up. It's in chapter 31, 10. Sounds like more and more like theology, these lectures. That's an equation number. The equation number from which the same formula is deduced. Well, the first thing then that we're going to do today is to study the behavior of the fields in empty space, away from all the currents after the ball is over, so to speak, or far away from the sources. I am not going to talk about the current, the fields right near the sources. Right near the source, I can tell you what the answer is. Right near the sources, if they're not moving too fast and wiggling too sharply, where the delays are important. In other words, if you're close enough, that in the time it takes light to go to where you are from where the source is, the source hasn't changed much in that much time, then the answers are that the fields are very much the same as we calculated in what we call the static cases, electrostatic or magnetic static cases. But as we get further away, so the delays become important, that we can get far away from the source. So what I want to discuss this time now is the behavior in a region in which there isn't any current and no charge density. Suppose that we ask what kind of fields can we have if we're away from the sources. Under those circumstances, rho is 0 and J is 0. And we find that there's an equation for the scalar potential, which is that the Laplacian of it is equal to 1 over c squared times its second derivative with respect to time. That the equation for the vector potential x component is exactly the same. Likewise, the y component. Likewise, the z component. Could I get that back, I hope? Thank you. And if this equation, this junk, equals 0, which is what we have to discuss, is the general form of the equation, let me put a psi in, because I don't have to worry about what the psi is. There are four cases. One, psi is the scalar potential, or psi is the x component of the vector potential, and so on. They all satisfy this equation. This equation is called a three-dimensional wave equation. Three dimensions because it has x, y, and z hidden in here. You know what this is. This is the second derivative of psi with respect to x, plus the second derivative of psi with respect to y, plus the second derivative of psi with respect to z, minus 1 over c squared times the second derivative of psi with respect to t. You say, I know that. Why do you write it over again? I write it over again because I like that equation. I like to see how it looks. Now, three dimensions, you have x, y, z, and of course the time. All right, four dimensions, you want to get elegant. Three space dimensions, though, anyway. Now, if this were true, say, for the vector potential A, and I took the curl of both sides, and the curl of this side is 0, And on this side, I have the same business, the second derivative and everything, of the curl of A, that is, of B. And therefore, we expect also that B satisfies the wave equation. And likewise, we can argue that E satisfies the wave equation, etc. So, let me, instead of working with a potential, just to work more directly, let's try another way of looking at it. Let's start with the Maxwell equation in a region where the currents and charges are zero, in which case the equations are that the divergence of E is equal to zero and that the curl of E is minus dB dt and that the divergence of B is also zero and that the C squared times the curl of B is minus dE dt. Now, the first case that I'm going to consider is a case in which nothing varies in Y and Z. Always do the easy case first so you can understand what's going to happen, and then you can go on to the more complicated cases. So first, let's suppose that things only depend upon X. Nothing depends on Y and Z. That's plane waves or whatever. Well, it's going to turn out to be plane waves in which nothing depends on the vertical direction. We get a case that depends only on X. We should expect to get an answer something like the answer here. You say, why not? Isn't it exactly the answer here? Yes, it is. Then why do it all over again? Well, it's important. A, B. When we got this, we worked it out by doing integrals, line integrals around, and we also got the solution for a specific current. The question we would like to answer is, what's the most general kind of a wave you could have in one dimension? And the only thing we can get that from is not to try to figure out what happens from this particular kind of a source, but to figure out what could happen in empty space in the most general case. Therefore, I will deal with this in the most general case. Also, we're going to work this time with differential equations instead of with integral forms. We'll get the same results, but it's just a way of practicing back and forth to show that it doesn't make any difference which way you go, but you should know how to do it every which way, because when you get a hard problem, only one of the various ways is tractable. Now, we suppose things depend only on X and Y. Then all the derivatives in here that say differentiate with respect to Y or with respect to Z or what have you are all zero. Only X and Y. For example, in the first equation, which begins dE sub X dx plus dE sub Y dy and so on, well, if nothing depends on Y and Z, that's all zero. So the first equation says that the rate of change of E sub X with X is zero. The only interesting variable is X, and that tells us that E sub X, the electric field in the X direction, is a constant field. That's not an interesting field, a constant field. That could have been that there was somebody had put condenser plates a million miles away, turned on some voltage, and we're in the constant field. We're not interested in such uninteresting phenomena, so we take the case that there's no average constant field. We're talking about a more dynamic thing that depends on time and so on. So we'll take the solution of this, the wave solution, the one that depends on time, that E sub X is zero. And that means what already? It means that if we're going to have any propagation of waves going in the direction X, that the electric field in the X direction is zero, or that the electric field, if it exists at all, and it does, is going to be at right angles to the direction of propagation. In agreement with that. The electric field is at right angles to the direction of propagation. It's a vector, and we can get a rather complicated solutions of where the electric field varies in direction with X and so on. But let's just first work out a case in which we suppose that the electric field is definitely along one axis. Suppose that we'll take electric field in the y direction not equal to zero, but the electric field in the z direction is equal to zero. Evidently, if we solve this problem, then we can solve the other case where the electric field in the z direction is not zero and y is. And the general solution, of course, is a superposition because these equations are linear. All right, so we take the electric field in the z direction as zero. The only component left is the y. How easy these equations get. In all derivatives, only the x derivative counts. In all e's, only the y component exists. Therefore, in the curl, the only combination of pairs of derivatives that'll come out is the dy dx is the only pieces of all these six derivatives in the curl which exists. And that belongs to the first term in the curl with respect to the z component of the curl. So this tells us that the rate of change of the electric field with x is the same as the rate of change in the magnetic field in the z direction with t. Oh, I also forgot to point out from here. I don't have to from here. Oh, yeah, I can get it from here. The x component of the magnetic field and the y component of the magnetic field both have zero time derivatives in this case. because this side is zero. And that means that there will be just some kind of constants due to somebody leaving some magnets lying in the room as the light is flying by. We're not interested in that. So we come to this, that the magnetic field in the x direction and the y direction is zero. Incidentally, I should have pointed out, before I took the special case that E was in the y direction, that the divergence of B equals zero produces in the same manner the restriction that the B field is also in the plane of right angles to the direction of propagation. So both E and B are at right angles to the direction of propagation. And this second step here only confirms it for the x component. But if E is in the y direction, then B is not in the y direction. It's only in the z direction. So we have another proposition that the B and E are at right angles to each other. It's exactly what happened in this special case. Now we have to one more equation. We've used up this one. And we have this equation here, which works this way. In this thing, only the z component of B exists, and only the x derivatives. And so it turns out to be that this combination of B sub z with respect to x is a piece, the negative part, is a piece of the derivative of the y component of the curl. And therefore, we have this pair of equations. All right? Now, from the first and from the last, from these two equations, we can get rid of something. If we would differentiate the first equation with respect to x, we'll find that the second derivative of x is equal to minus the derivative of B, what is it, z, with respect to x and t, or t and x. All right, t and x. But the B sub z dx is 1 over c squared dE dt, and therefore, I missed up a sign somehow. Thank you. Right, Maxwell. See, I should know Maxwell. For you, you get the answer wrong in the quiz, but I have some guys to tell me when I make a mistake. Now we have d dx here, and so it becomes, I flunked. It should be, damn it, when it's right, 1 over c squared times the second derivative of y with respect to t squared. If it doesn't come out of my equations, I made a mistake. So therefore, we have that Ey satisfies an equation of this form. All theoretical physicists love to have their equations equal zero. So a much more familiar form to a high-class theoretical physicist to put it that way. But that's a lot of gamesmanship, you see. That's all. That's the same equation. Now, this equation we have studied previously because this was the equation we found for the propagation of sound. We called it the wave equation. It's the wave equation for one-dimensional propagation. I show you a special solution. Special solution is any shape which is the same as time goes on, produces its same shape again, moved over by a distance ct as time goes on. Translating that mumbling into words, a special solution to this is some function of x minus ct. That is, a function of x given, say, t equals 0. This is a function of x where, say, its maximum is at x equals 0. Then if you put t equals 75, then you'll have the same function of x, except it's displaced. The new maximum occurs where x equals 75c. So as time goes on, the curve moves along. Let me show you that this is a solution of this equation. Any function f will do. Now, to do it, we have to differentiate with respect to x. And we have f prime of x minus ct. By prime, I mean a derivative of this function. If I differentiate it again, I get the second derivative of this function. Now I need the time derivatives. If I take d psi dt, that's a little more complicated. I differentiate a function of x minus ct with respect to c, then I differentiate the function, and then I see that, oh, you know how it is. If you don't know how it is, it's too bad. Anyway, this is right. And if you do it again, you bring out another C and another minus sign and get the second derivative. And so you see, in fact, that the second derivative with respect to x and the second derivative with respect to t differ by a factor C squared as required by the equation. Now you might ask, Well, if I had the equation, how would I know to take that as a solution? I don't like this backwards method. You guess, you write down a solution, show me that it's a solution. I want a forward method. Well, a forward method is to know it's a solution. There's no forward method. I mean, there can be. You can cook up an an imaginary argument, which is kind of designed because you know that with an equation it's as simple as this. We don't have to play games. This is the answer. The moment you see that equation, boom, you should see this answer. In the same way as if you're asked to do an integral of x squared dx, you right away see x cubed over 3. So when you see this thing, you see that. Well, a better man would see more. Not only is x minus ct a solution, but of course x plus ct is also a solution. If I change the sign of c, I would get a solution. So x minus, any function of x minus ct plus any other function of x plus ct is a solution. That's all solutions of this equation must have this mathematical form. Nobody can find one that doesn't, it says here, I think. Because I believe that there's a theorem, but I'm not sure of myself, that when there's a second derivative of a differential equation, that the most general solution has two arbitrary functions in it, and this has two arbitrary functions. As a small amusement, consider the following. Cosine 3x, or kx, times cosine of kcx, kct. Now that obviously doesn't this form. It's the product of a function of x and a function of time. Have you ever, you try to substitute this solution into here and see if it's a solution. It will be. Does it, why or am I not consistent? Puzzle. Okay, now the next, oh, I just see it. It's too easy, this puzzle. Now we have just discovered then from the property of mathematics, a property of the differential equation, which we already learned in the case of sound, that this equation can be represent a wave moving this way. And this superposition just means the sum of two solutions. One is a wave moving this way, and the other is a wave moving that way. So the equation that we have obtained for EY tells us that EY can vary in space in an arbitrary fashion. However, it varies the whole thing. The whole variation will sail through space at a speed c, with the E and the B perpendicular. That's light, or radio waves, or infrared, or ultraviolet, or x-rays, and so on. And we've already discussed light in great detail. So all I'm making now are contacts with previous knowledge. I won't, therefore, go much further into the behavior of these waves. You know how the electric and magnetic field do behave when you have oscillating charges generating waves. And they behave in the way that this equation, as a differential equation, describes. With regard to the question of polarization, then we made the choice that E was in the y direction. There's another solution where E is in the z direction. The function of x and t in which y varies and which z varies need not be the same. So if I superpose those two solutions by adding, of course, I again get a solution. Why? The original equations of the whole works here are linear. So if I have one solution and another and add the two together, it'll also be a solution. We've talked about that. Therefore, we can have a solution in which the E is not necessarily always in the y direction, nor always exactly in some other direction. Because if I added a wave where z is in the y direction with some kind of strength, and where z is in the z direction with a different kind of strength, varying in a different way, then the resultant field would do something like this. And so we can obtain a description of polarized light. But the electric field will, of course, always be perpendicular to the direction of motion of the waves. And the magnetic field will be perpendicular to the electric field. If you want to get the sign right of which way does the electric and magnetic field go relative to each other, then the answer is the following. If you calculate, if you look at E cross B, that is, you turn E into B by a right-hand screw. That's the direction in which the wave is moving. E cross B is in the direction in which the wave is. That's just a way of remembering the sign. However, it does have a physical significance, because as we'll learn later, this is the formula E cross B, which determines the direction in which the energy, the flow rate, rather, of the energy that's carried by the field. We don't know that yet, but it's an easy thing by which we can remember the directions. Frau, if I now turn to the equation in three dimensions, which is this, perhaps the first thing to do is to show that the electric field vector E satisfies that same wave equation. Well, I claim to have already done it for B by by arguing about the potentials. But let's just for fun look again at the Maxwell equations and now not restrict ourselves to any direction and see if we can find out what equation E satisfies. By taking the curl of the second equation, I find out that this is true. But the curl of B is given in the fourth equation. And therefore, this is 1 over C squared times the second derivative of E with respect to T, any component. Put vectors on it all over the place. I left out the arrows. E and B and A and grad are all vectors. So those are the ones that get the arrows. Now, the curl of something by this back cab business with vectors comes out to be the gradient of the divergence minus the Laplacian. And that has to equal the other stuff. And the divergence is 0, ha, 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 from the first equation. So look, the Laplacian of E is 1 over C squared times the second derivative of E with respect to T. Naturally, as we expect. So this, then, is the characteristic wave equation in three dimensions, which is written here in ingloriously expanded form. What is the characteristic of that? The answer is that all the solutions of this can be represented as superpositions of the solutions that we already have found. We have found the solution in which we move in the x direction by supposing things didn't depend on y and z. Evidently, there's another solution in which you say it doesn't depend on x and z and goes up in a y direction or goes in a z direction. Or, by rotating the coordinate system, since this system of equations has no reference to coordinates because the Laplacian is invariant under rotations and so on, this equation permits a solution in which we have a plane wave moving east by northeast or any other direction. And so the conditions of the electric and magnetic field in empty space can be represented, if you wish, by a superposition of plane waves running around in all directions. Therefore, I want you to imagine what's going on in the space in this room, according to this point of view. What are the electric and magnetic fields doing? First of all, there's a steady DC magnetic field from the center of that comes from some currents in the interior of the Earth in a mysterious fashion, which is the Earth's magnetic field. Then there are some kind of irregular electric fields that come because some fellows have combed their hair or have moved in the chairs and the friction has produced some charge distributions and there's some field. We're not interested in those sort of DC fields. Then because there are wires and light in the lighting system and so on, there are oscillating currents that are fed by the generator in Boulder Dam at 60 cycles, and so there's a moving oscillating field, E and B, slopping back and forth at 60 times a second. In addition, there are fields that are slopping in this space at higher frequencies more rapidly. For instance, I look at you, you look at me, a guy looks across the room. What he sees is coming through, according to this point of view, on some kind of waves which are riding very rapidly, 186,000 miles a second it is that these little wheels go shooting through the space. A little more energy than is usually carried by one of the wiggles. I'm glad that nobody was in the target area. But not only the stuff that we can see, but also the infrared light, the ultraviolet light, and the x-rays, and the radio waves. For example, right now, moving through here are signals from which one can hear Elvis Presley. Or there are signals which represent a series of impulses, pictures of events going on in other parts, news events going on in other parts of the world, or pictures of aspirin dissolving in imaginary stomachs. Right now, right through this room. And if you don't believe it, then it's only necessary to build a piece of equipment to detect this. So sensitive are our instruments that these tiny fields that are produced in Mount Wilson can be picked up, and you too can be convinced that that's the right kind of aspirin to buy for yours. But less trivially, there are signals infinitesimal signals from enormous distances. There are tiny wiggles that are about a foot across, their irregularities, that are going right through here now, that have come from 40 million miles away, from a small an antenna about so big, or maybe it's 10 or 15 feet, I don't know, that's on the Mariner 2 that tells us what's going on in Venus. And how does it know what's going on in Venus? Because there were little waves wiggling out of Venus that went into this Mariner 2 and which were transformed to a different frequency of oscillation. Well, we see, why don't we just observe Mariner 2's waves directly? The instruments aren't good enough, is all, and so we made a repeater station. Because around here, there's just too much infrared from the hot bodies and other objects with the charges oscillating. There is very little natural oscillation at the frequency of a billion cycles per second. So if we make an instrument which transmits the information at a billion cycles per second, then by looking for that particular frequency, we have very little background. And so we can tell an object a million miles away. Next time you go out in the sky, look at Venus. You can't see that it has any size at all. That's what? Some 8,000 miles across, approximately, like the Earth. And next to it there was a little tiny thing, only 16 feet across, that an instrument can detect that tiny pinpoint in space. And an instrument that's no bigger than the room. It picks up the electric and magnetic fields, which are those little wiggles which are coming from such a distance. And then there are wiggles that come from the stars and from the galaxies beyond. You say the light and also the electromagnetic waves. In fact, the radio waves come from further than we can see. And everything that's happening, there's lightning going somewhere, then there's a little of electric field. So I ask you then to imagine this electric and magnetic field. How do I imagine the electric and magnetic field? What do I actually see? What is the requirement of scientific imagination? Is it in some sense no harder than to imagine that the room is full of angels, invisible angels? It's just like invisible angels. No, it's not like invisible angels. It requires a much higher degree of imagination to understand the electromagnetic field than to understand invisible angels. Why? Because all I have to do to modify and to make invisible angels understandable is to alter their properties a little bit. I make them slightly visible. And then I can see the wings, I can see the angels. It's very easy. So the abstraction required, which is to take almost invisible angels and imagine them completely invisible, is relatively easy. But if you try to say, what can I, please, will you, Professor, please tell me how I should modify my picture of the electromagnetic waves so that I too can see those as well as I could see almost invisible angels, and then I'll modify the picture to its abstraction. I don't know how. I have no picture of this electromagnetic field that's in any sense accurate. I know about the electromagnetic field. I was in the same position as you, 25 years ago, and I have 25 years of experience thinking about this wiggling walk. When I start to describe the fields moving around in the space and waving my arms, you imagine I see them. I tell you what I see. I see some kind of vague sort of shadowy wiggling lines. Here and there is an E and a B written on them somehow. An arrow here or there, which disappears when I look too closely at it, and so forth. When I talk about the thing slurping through space, I see a C. I have a terrible confusion between the symbols which I use to describe the object and the objects themselves. I don't have a picture of the objects themselves. I cannot really make a picture that's nearly like the true waves. If you have some difficulty then in doing that, I would say, I don't think that's unusual. The science requires a terrific strain on imagination. The imagination that's required is much more extreme than the imagination that was required for some of the ancient ideas. The modern ideas are much harder to imagine. We use a lot of tools, though. We use mathematical equations and rules and make a lot of pictures. And what I realize is that when I talk about the electromagnetic field in space, I see some kind of a superposition of all of the diagrams which I've ever seen drawn about this thing. I don't see little bundles of field lines and knots running about, because it worries me that if I ran at a different speed, the bundles will disappear. I don't even see the electric and magnetic fields because in a moment I could say maybe I should have made the picture with the vector potential and the scalar potential, and those were the things which were wiggling. So the only hope, you say, is to take a mathematical view. Now, what is a mathematical view? Mathematical view says there's electric and magnetic field vector at every point in space. That's six numbers associated with every point. Can you imagine six numbers associated with every point? Too hard. Let's try one number associated with every point. Can you imagine one number associated with every point? I cannot. I can imagine an example of the temperature at every point. That's understandable. There's a quantity, but I know what that is. It's a hot and coldness, which varies from place to place. So I can understand the idea of a temperature at every point, but I honestly do not understand the idea of a number at every point. So the question is, can we represent this electric field by something more like a temperature, like a displacement of a piece of jello? Imagine a world were filled with thin jello. Abstract the jello away. Imagine the jello was wiggling so. That's what people struggled with in order to understand electromagnetism for many years. And it turns out that the attempt to do it that way was really what was standing in the way of progress to understand the thing. We are unfortunately limited to abstractions, to using instruments to detect the field, to using mathematical symbols to describe the fields, and so on. But nevertheless, in some sense, the fields are real. Because after we're all finished fiddling around with the mathematical equations without making the pictures and drawings or anything, or actually visualizing the thing, we can still make the instrument detect the signals from Mariner 2, find out about galaxies that are billions of miles away, and so on. This whole question of how that you have to have imagination in science is often misunderstood by people in other fields, because sometimes they give some kind of a test. They say, here is the circumstances, what would you imagine was happening? And nobody who's scientific can ever say. And the reason is that we have trained ourselves to a very definite circumstance, that whatever we imagine has to be consistent with everything we know. That is, these electric fields and these wigglings and everything else are not just a happy thought, wouldn't it be nice if, but they're required in order to explain and to connect with everything that we know. We're not allowing ourselves to imagine things which are obviously in contradiction to directly observed things. And so the kind of imagination is quite a difficult game. One has to have imagination to think of something that cannot see, never saw before, never heard of before, create something in the mind. At the same time, this thing has to be created in a straitjacket with exactly a certain shape, which are the conditions of the known world. And the problem is to think of something which is different than has been thought of before, which is consistent, which was everything that's been seen before, is one of extreme difficulty. The next thing that I don't know if it's ever possible about, I would like to just talk about, and that is whether we can imagine beauty that we cannot see. It's an interesting question. We look at a rainbow, and it's beautiful. They say, I mean, it looks good. Everybody says, ooh, a rainbow. You see how scientific I am. I'm afraid to say something is beautiful unless I have an experimental way of defining that. Okay, I define it. Everybody says, ooh. Okay. But how would we describe a rainbow if we were blind? As we are blind when we measure the infrared reflection coefficient of sodium chloride, as we talk about the frequency, the waves that are coming from some galaxy that we can't see, we only radio waves, and we make a diagram, we make a plot. For instance, the plot would be wavelength here, intensity of radiation. Now it would be discovered, say, by somebody making, blind men now, making measurements on the rainbow that at certain conditions of the weather, there's a light intensity which varies with the angle from the line toward the sun. And if you measure the intensity at a given direction, it has a certain spectral distribution. For example, I didn't have time to look up the angles, so I'm going to make arbitrary angles in here. You might find that the spectral distribution is measured by a spectral photometer and so on. You're all blind, just measuring these things. When it's set at an angle of 20 degrees from the direction opposite the sun, it looks like this. We know it looks something like this because it's red, you know, long wavelengths. Special. Now, if we increase the angle, we find that it's more reflection in the middle of the spectrum, in the greenish yellow. So maybe this is 22 degrees. I wish I get the right angles someday, but I don't know what they are. And then we make a curve to represent a higher angle, say 24 degrees, and so. And so we see published in the Physical Review of the Blind Men a series of curves, and it's marked the intensity of reflection as a function of angle from the direction opposite the sun. And that's all there is to a rainbow. The fact that the curves are in different places means that there's different colors associated with the angles. In fact, there's more to this curve, much more detail than there is when you look at a rainbow, because the eye can't see the exact shapes. But the eye finds a rainbow beautiful. Do we have enough imagination someday to see in the curves any beauty that we cannot see directly with the senses? I don't know. We already claim to see a certain beauty in the equations. There's something nice about X and the Y and the Z and the T, you know, boom, boom. It's got something. And this fact that there's something nice with the X, with the Y, with the Z and the T is not just boompity, 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 boomp. It suggests to the mind still a greater beauty, which has to do with the four dimensions of possibility that space has a four-dimensional symmetry. The possibility of analyzing that and the developments of the special theory of relativity. So there is in the intellect plenty of beauty associated with the equations. I don't know whether I can ever look at the reflection coefficient of sodium chloride as a function of angles and so on in the infrared and see how it would look if my eyes could see it. Some glowing, sheening green crystal with reflections from the surface in red. That would be a beautiful thing. But I can't see it, and I just thought we would just have some fun to discuss this question of scientific imagination. This has taken me so much time that I have left out many of the things, as you can see from the summary, that I expected to talk about in this lecture. So we'll have it next lecture. Yes, sir. See, already the schedule is going off. Huh? The schedule is going off already, you see. Already the schedule's off. I ran away with myself. I guess you enjoy it anyway.
I did. May I ask a sort of a personal question?
Yeah.
Because I got into a fight, not an argument of sort, over this over the vacation.
What?
Out of curiosity, how would you define beauty?
Define what?
Beauty.
Oh, I don't know. I.
You can't come up with one.
Everybody says, ooh. No. I don't know. No, that's...
I made a statement, science is beautiful.
And they said it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Oh, well, it's...
Finally, we worked it down that the possibility of having some reason is pleasing to the intellect, and that's about it.
Well, yeah, but if you try to say anything about anything else being beautiful, you'd end up with some kind of a... When you say the ballet is beautiful, it's pleasing to the senses. Funny, it takes a certain intellect. I mean, you have to just be looking at it. It's not the same thing as being stroked pleasantly. By the ballet dancer.
What interests me is that...
So it's very similar, intellectual pleasure and beauty are probably the same in the moment he granted, whoever it was, that there was intellectual pleasure in the contemplation of something, then it's very close, because it's hard to say. There's a character of the pleasure you have to argue about now. Whether it's the kind of pleasure you get out of solving a puzzle is the same kind of pleasure as you get out of looking at a beautiful thing and so on and so on.
What interests me is...
Very hard.
all we have in the world is, I mean, all we have in our minds is what we've seen, taken in, notebooks.
Right, and talking to your friends.
And talking to your friends. I didn't see the point. But what interests me is, where do we get the discriminatory power to feel personally that something is beautiful or something is intellectually pleasing? Because where in the world do we have something that tells us that there is a difference in values?
I don't know. I don't know where that value business came from and associated with beauty. One thing that is I always find very interesting is the following. We agree that the peacock's feathers are a glorious thing. Does anybody ever else see them than us? Are the animals, for example, already aware of beauty? It's a good question, because then you answer questions, how does it develop in life, not how does it develop in man? Mm-hmm. So the question is, are the animals interested in beauty? Well, first you want, from the theory of evolution, if the theory of evolution is right, how does that peacock feathers get that way?
Perhaps to attract the male.
To attract the female, the peacock is the male, right. To attract the female. But then the precision, I mean, the improvement to get more eyes and to get more color and more reflections and so on, is to more attract the female, right? So the female peacock, or peahen, as it's called, may have some kind of appreciation of the thing. That is the same kind of appreciation we had. If we could, for example, mold it, if we had in our hands the possibility of saying, I like this one better than that one, if you look at two peacocks, and always choose the better peacock, we would produce by evolution gradually a beautiful thing. But what's produced is we consider already beautiful. So it may already be that existing, even at the level of the birds, there's something analogous to our ideas of a beautiful thing. I don't know. It's the nearest I've come to thinking about your question in any way other than just talking about it.
It's really something to think about.
Yeah.
You may have neglected one thing. Doesn't the peahen look at the wrong side of the peacock?
No.
Feathers?
I'm sure that's not the case. No. If that happened, then you'd be in a difficult position in evolution to understand how it would come about.
Yeah, isn't there a certain dance also?
Yeah,
they have a dance and they have... Yeah, but they turn and they do all kinds of...
Yeah.
I give the peahen credit for the beauty of the peacock. Well, I don't see any other way. But on the other hand, there is beauty in the sky and in the sunsets and so on. Of course, that's not evolved. That's something we appreciate somehow. I don't know where it comes from.
And another thing, when we notice colors, and we see two colors that go together and they look pretty, and you would see these two colors in one instance, and then you'd see them in nature. Now, perhaps in one instance, these two colors look terrible, like in a dime store. You might see orange and black together or something like that. Terrible. See it in an orange sky and black trees, and it looks lovely.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
We've got a question from last.
Yes, sir.
This area here, it has a uniform magnetic field in it.
Right.
And it's increasing uniform.
Right.
We put a charge in here someplace.
Right.
Does charge move?
Might.
We were drawing these circles here.
That's right. That's right. Right.
But if you throw one over here,
that's right.
Then it's going to go that's the right. Other way.
You can't calculate the electric field from one equation alone. You see, we like to do it by using these theorems. That's a shortcut when things are symmetrical. But all you know is that the circulation around the thing must be the flux of B.
Yeah.
But there are several solutions, as you already point out. You see, you could start saying, suppose the electric field is zero here or something. And there's more than one solution. And the complete thing depends upon the conditions on the boundary out here. So you haven't got enough equations when you just tell about the circulation. It's also give the condition that the divergence is zero, and also, what happens far away? Otherwise, you can't solve it. You can't, what kind of symmetry there is out here? Because that's not so unimportant what happened. How does the field fall off out here is an important part of this problem. The trouble with this problem is that you haven't defined, yes.
Yeah, in the book,
through the concentric circles.
They always, whenever they consider it, they always draw a circle like this and put it in there.
Well, it would be nice, but as you explain yourself, I didn't also, in the lecture, I looked at the notes just yesterday that has been written up on what happens with a uniform field, what the vector potentials are and what the fields are, and I did the same thing. I mean, it was talked in there, you take an arbitrary center. But you could get more than one solution by starting in different centers. But you can only find out when you get out here. So that, for instance, way out here, when you get far enough away, then it's symmetrical. Around an average position there. Then, yes, no, it's quite right. That argument is too simple. And in a uniform field of a round thing, it's easy to figure out because you know that the... But any other shape, you need more equations, and particularly what happens out beyond. You can't tell from just looking here without looking at the boundary. It depends on how it stops out here. Yeah, it's complicated. It's unfortunate, but that's quite right, yes. Yeah, and there's a little sloppy in our own notes on this question. Not for the magnetic field, but we compute the vector potential from a uniform field. We did it. We gave several different possible answers, and then we also gave one by this argument. But it only checked with one. We checked with one of the answers, so at least there was clear there was some ambiguity. But there's no unique. The unique field here depends upon how this boundary is and what happens outside. Yeah, that's why I said it may and it may not. Depending on where it is, yeah. Yeah.
Are these F and G supposed to both be individual solutions of the...
Arbitrary functions. Any function at all. Pick a function. Put it in for F, then it's a solution. Then all the solutions of this equation have this mathematical form, some function of x minus ct plus some other function of x plus ct.
Shouldn't the complex solution have arbitrary constants in
there? In the functions. The functions were arbitrary.
Well, have umpteen arbitrary constants.
Right. Okay? In fact, you see, yes, it's right. You think arbitrary constants are when you don't have a partial differential equation, then you have a number of arbitrary constants. If you had a total differential equation, you know, second derivative with respect to x plus 3x times the first derivative with respect to x, and the only variable is x, then the solution has two arbitrary constants. When it's a partial differential equation, it has two arbitrary functions, as I remember from somewhere, but I suspect it. Is it true, generally?
What's that?
That a second-order differential, partial differential equation has two arbitrary functions in the general
solution.
In the general solution.
Integrating it partially with respect to one of the variables, then you can add on an arbitrary function to the other variable.
So that you have proved that a differential equation with two variables has one arbitrary function. And it's quite different than the statement that no matter how many variables, if it's a second order, then it's two arbitrary functions. It's completely different. So it's not so easy to...
Right. Yes. If it was a u cubed plus d log u plus and so on. You have them, the a, b, and so on, all arbitrary functions. So there is an infinite number of arbitrary functions. Any old function.
I don't know. I don't remember this...
I think it's true, but something bothered me. I got into some difficulty somewhere doing something, so it's probably just I always knew the theorem, but...
What you're really proving is that it's arbitrary functions of two different combinations of the variable, the x minus ct and x plus ct.
Well, two linearly independent combinations.
Yeah, two linearly independent.
No, but generally speaking, never mind this particular equation. There's probably a theorem which says that a partial differential equation with a second order in R
has two linearly independent combinations of the variables.
It's two linearly independent functions.